You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 283, The Gentrification of Pop. How much would you pay to meet Britney Spears? The topsy-turvy world of Ronald Koeman and the return of Ian Holloway. And how music provides a soundtrack to our lives in good times and bad. That's all coming up after Sigma, Paloma Faith and Changing.
Hell down heaven now, living in the same town, trying to find something new. Broken picture frame, I've been frozen in, trying to find a better view. This ain't me, this ain't cool, this ain't what I signed up to.
It was me that picked that this week, and that's not usually my sort of thing at all, but I have to say it was played to me, and she's been insistent that I tell you this on the podcast. So my 60 something year old mother is very keen on this and played it to me when I went round there the other day, and I have to say I rather liked it as well. It has been on if you're an ITV viewer, it's been on everything ever, apparently, X Factor adverts, all that sort of thing. But I'm rather a fan of Paloma Faith, and I particularly like how snazzily up that is. So that is Sigma featuring Paloma Faith, and that is Changing.
Well, I'm far more out of touch than your cool mother, because I was unaware of that, even though it had been number one in the UK, apparently, like 2 years ago. Welcome to episode 283 of the Parish Council podcast, where we look at music, media, sport and life with all the verve and enthusiasm of Wayne Rooney at a wedding reception.
Poor old Wayne, it was his day off,
I agree. I talk about overblown.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm Terence Dackham, and speaking of verve and style, it's Juliet Harris.
and then things that I do not have. Hello and good morning.
This week, I was much taken by an opinion piece by the writer John Harris in your increasingly expensive Your Guardian.
And absolutely. Although John Harris is one of the finest writers, I think, doing their thing in newspapers at the moment. And also, I met him once and he was a very nice man.
Oh, that's good to hear. Mm. Now, the piece is broadly about the way pop music culture is being driven by 21st century capitalism, a culture, as John Harris puts it, of inequality, where a form of bespoke products are being produced, not for the mass market, but as a type of luxury goods. And where most of us might be the sort of Waitrose or Tesco of pop music, these are packages for the Harrods or Harvey Nichols elite. And one of the examples John Harris provides is the rather ludicrous new offering from Pink Floyd. It's a box set entitled The Early Years, 1965 to 1972, which kind of as well implies that this is the first in a set of many. But anyway, what do you get in the early years 65-72? Well, a rather over-the-top 27 set of discs, 42 items of memorabilia, 5 reproduction vinyl singles and 3 feature films. Now, how much for that lot? An extraordinary £375.99. And do you know what? Somehow it's the 99 pence that feels like the worst of that sum to me. You know.
Yes, it's derisory, isn't it, really? It's a bit arbitrary. Why not just make it, why not round it up?
I just picture a record company sort of marketing meeting. They say, yeah, I reckon we'll get away with 375 quid on this, you know, boys. And someone says, add on another 99 pence.
Or no, my view is someone's gone, well, I don't think people will pay £376 for this, but I think they will pay £375.99. That's different. It's all psychology, Dave, says someone in a marketing meeting.
I've got no doubt that some Pink Floyd fans will actually argue that this all represents good value. And of course, you'll be first in the queue, Jules.
Absolutely, yeah. I can understand, and actually a bit of background on this, I can understand why John Harris is perhaps so perturbed about Pink Floyd, because he has written books about Pink Floyd before, I think. I've certainly bought one, I think, for my dad. I will not be paying £375.99.
That's one sale lost.
Absolutely, yes, in your face, the man. Mm-hmm. I'm not box set averse as such. I mean, I bought a Stax box set of the singles on a CD a little while ago, and I don't think that was a huge amount, actually. It might have been about £30 or £40. And it is excellent. It's really, really good. So I'm not necessarily against buying stuff that has been repackaged. I think sometimes that can be a good thing. But I think that the pricing is extracting fluid sometimes, I must admit. We've got some other examples here. Your Kate Bush, of whom you are so very fond. Yes, I always associate the two of you in my mind. You went to see her, of course, when you went to all those shows at Hammersmith. You went to the opening night, didn't you?
I did.
And you can buy different versions of her. Basically, you can buy a sort of they're releasing it on DVD and film and all that, and CD and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So if you want to buy, and I think this is perhaps particularly relevant to vinyl, and we've talked about vinyl on the podcast before, and you know, you don't quite, I don't think you quite understand why I'm such a vinyl enthusiast.
Not really, no.
But you know, there's all the new vinyl is coming out, and I think there are some unscrupulous people that are using this as a way of thinking, oh well, you know, people will pay a lot more because people now fetishize vinyl again. If you want to buy the 3 CD version of Before the Dawn by Kate Bush, you can pay £15 for that on the website. That's okay. Like a
reasonable.
Absolutely. If you want to buy the 4-disc, the 4 LP vinyl edition, that will cost you £60, or rather £59.99.
that disappoints
which
me.
Which is irritating, really. You don't get, from having a look at it, I'm just trying to look to see if you get anything else, and I don't think you get anything extra on the vinyl that you don't get on the CD. It looks to me like all the tracks are the same, so you're just paying for 8 sides of vinyl rather than necessarily the CDs. If you're put off by Kate Bush, perhaps you'd like a little bit of heavy metal instead. That seems an obvious step to take, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Your Deep Purple. You can buy a singles collection of Deep Purple. Yeah, I know. You're lacking enthusiasm already, which makes me think you might not want to pay this price.
I can only think of one single, which is Black
Smoke
Night.
Smoke on the Water.
Oh, well, I didn't think Smoke on the Water as well. Yes. Yeah.
So maybe. That's, I mean, true. There are 11 CD singles in this box set, right. So there are some other hits as well. You can go to that website that's named after a river. Just a mere £579.25. In comparison, if you want Gods of Thunder, the legendary broadcast by Kiss, 1974 to 1994, a 4 CD box set, that will just cost you £14.99, which seems a lot more sensible, doesn't it?
That is outrageous. That is beyond. That's beyond the Pink Floyd thing.
Whereas AC/DC, Hell's Radio, the legendary broadcast, 1974 to 1979, 6 CD set, £14.99.
Well,
so it can be done, and I think that it's not every box set ever is eye-gougingly expensive as Deep Purple. However, it does, because they are aimed at, and we could go back to our concept of 50 quid man here, I think, that was pioneered in the Word magazine. I think they're aimed at people like that, and I say people, I don't think 50 quid man necessarily should be gendered, but, you know, you see what I mean. And I think of... When I went into Sounds of the Universe in Soho recently, and then I went into, what's the other one called? Selector Disc, I think. And they had all their box sets up. So you can't, they're not they're in captivity, they're not in the wild. So you go up to the counter and they're all above there. They're all literally on a sort of a plinth above the guy's heads. And you see them all labelled up. And some of them you think, yeah, that's reasonable. That Jam 4 CD box set for sort of £25, I can see that. There's a nice book with it. And then when you see, you know, the complete singles collection of Deep Purple, for example, for £525,
£25.
You know, that's years worth of gas for me in my flat. You know, I don't quite. Yeah, so I'm not anti box sets as such, and I suspect we have listeners that are very, very enthusiastic about them, but I'm anti them being wildly overpriced, because they're priced in that way because someone will pay that money for that. That, you know, that's the retail reality, isn't it? I'm cross that I feel in a way that they're exploiting people that will pay that money for that. I'm not hugely keen on gouging as a concept.
No, I couldn't agree more. That Deep Purple is actually taking my breath away. That's astonishing.
Isn't it, really?
Yeah. Well, apart
and
from...
And 25 pence as well. That's
That really is. Again, it's like the Pink Floyd with their 99p. It's kind of just, it just immediately makes you think of gouging as much as they possibly can, doesn't it? Apart from the, the audacious markup for not sleeping in a tent at Glastonbury next year. Now, £6,000 for two people to sleep in a caravan is what they're offering.
Why would you not just take your own caravan? You could hire one for cheaper than that, I'm sure.
Sure, you could, but as you say, some people who perhaps have more money than sense, they're just, I imagine, appealing to a market that must exist. It must be...
Yeah, hedge funders that still think they're cool, I think.
I suppose so. It must be the same people as the Deep Purple £500 people. But one of the newer developments that seems on a sharp increase is the meet and greet package, where an artist or a group, they go on tour, and not content with raking in astonishing profits from the traditional ticket sales, we're now offered VIP packages where you receive, it seems to me, I've looked into this a little bit, you get a laminate quite often to hang around your neck, maybe a glass of champagne on arrival, a glossy programme, and a 5-second opportunity to meet and greet the artist while a photographer takes a quick photo, and you're moved on. Now, I stumbled across this the other week whilst I was looking at the social media app Periscope, where people, you know, people can share live footage of their day-to-day existence.
And although I'm meant to be the young hip one on this podcast, I would not know what Periscope was if you weren't so enthusiastic about it, I don't think. You were very much an early adopter of
it. I was.
I see Periscope through your eyes.
I quite enjoy it. It's part of Twitter now. Twitter bought it up, inevitably.
Ah, yes. They buy everything, don't they? They're more Facebook.
Well, because you get they're under threat. Periscope's under threat because Facebook Live is really the Facebook equivalent of Periscope, and they're
I took part in one on Friday evening, so yes, I am aware of it.
Well, I was looking at Periscope, as I say, and there was Tony Braxton, who had a decent run of hits that seemed to dry up. It was around the turn of the millennium, seemed to, the new millennium.
I think I remember hearing her on the radio in the 90s as a teenager, and then after that, not really hearing of her again.
I think the Unbreak My Heart hitmaker is how she would be referred to now. But here she was, Tony Braxton, on tour backstage. And I watched, they were doing this meet and greet, and I watched as each VIP package purchaser was sort of ushered into the presence of Tony Braxton. And a bloke took two photos, like snap, snap, like that, and an assistant assisted the VIP package person away. And they were with the package person was with Tony Braxton for somewhere between 5 and 10 seconds, depending on the speed of the photographer. And I noticed, other than a quick sort of, oh, hello, no words were exchanged at all, and, you know, they were moved on. And so I thought, well, I'll check out the cost of this adventure of the meet and greet Tony Braxton on tour. Yeah, $472.75 for that 10 seconds.
That's a lot of money.
Seems a lot, but Tony Braxton is on the foothills of Everest compared to more contemporary artists. So Britney Spears is on tour at the moment in America. And if you want your photo taken with Britney at a meet and greet, $2,500. $2,500 to be in Britney Spears' presence for 10 seconds and have a photo taken, which I assume is then emailed to you.
You could get 4 Deep Purple box sets for that.
You could, and that suddenly seems value compared to this. I think we were creating pop billionaires, and I'm not sure I'd pay to meet anyone in the world, but I was wondering, Jules, would you pay for a meet and greet with PJ Harvey?
No, I wouldn't, because I don't ever want to meet PJ Harvey. And I say this as, I'm sure she's lovely, I'm sure she's very pleasant, but I would not feel comfortable with it. I would not. When I say I don't ever want to meet PJ Harvey, I don't want to meet her as a fan. I would love to work with her at some point. I'd love to write about her, maybe collaborate on something. That would be wonderful, or play in her band. Any of those things would be, you know, a dream. But I don't want to meet her on a fan basis, because I would just not be able to deal with the dynamics of that. I would not want to do, and not because, you know, I wouldn't want to meet her in another context, but just because I don't, that's not something I'm comfortable with. Having said this, though, I've got another meet and greet story for you.
And
people might remember this. So Avril Lavigne, the complicated skater boy hit maker, who had some success in the early to mid noughties, I think that was her kind of time, and then things inevitably because she was a bit of a teeny bopper kind of idol. I know they tried to make her a bit more edgy, and she was very keen on wearing vests and ties together, if I remember correctly. if anyone can't see my eye roll, you can definitely hear it. But she was a bit of a kind of an would-be alternative singer, I think is perhaps a rather cruel but accurate way of putting it. Hits had sort of dried up. In 2014, a story emerged. We can talk about emerging markets. I think that applies in music as well as industry. Artists going to new territories to find untapped sources of income. She went to Brazil and did some meet and greets in Brazil. It cost you $400 to have your picture taken with Avril Lavigne. Sure. But this is the cat. This is the catch here. The catch is she had a no touching policy, so you can't put your arm around Avril Lavigne. So there's a lovely series here. I might try to send you the link after so we can put it out. Lovely series of incredibly awkward looking pictures of Avril Lavigne stood next to, in some cases about a foot away, in other cases almost shoulder to shoulder. Men and women seem to be different here, and the men are stood further away, both looking, well, not hugely cheered by the situation, really. And someone paid $400 for that. BuzzFeed then did a fantastic picture article contrasting Avril Lavigne's meet and greets with Rihanna's meet and greets. And the Rihanna pictures are excellent. She you know, is joking with fans. She has hands all over them. She's giving one a piggyback at one point. I mean, they look a lot of fun. And I think if you pay a lot of money to have your picture taken with someone on this evidence, I'd be delighted to have my picture taken with Rihanna. I'm not sure how much I'd pay for it, but, you know, there's her kissing someone in a wheelchair. She seems delightful. She, you know, I'm a fan of Rihanna on this, but I think she's good anyway, but on this basis. Mm. So yes, I seem to be very anti-everything this week. I'm not anti-box sets, but I'm anti-paying too much for box sets. And if people want to pay to meet their sort of their idols, I think I'm, again, it's similar principle applies. I'm perfectly okay with that, but I'm not okay with the idea of people being gouged. So, you know, it would make sense to pay money to Rihanna to meet and greet her if she's going to be as delightful as she seems to be in these pictures. To pay $400 to Avril Lavigne and not even be able to put an arm round each other to have a sort of fairly relaxed photo is not okay, in my view.
The Avril photo sounds as awkward as those when you see wedding photos where the mother and father of the bride are no longer speaking to each other.
Yes.
And you see the wedding photo and they're standing about 6 feet apart, kind of glaring at the camera. If you like West Coast sunshiny melodic pop, exactly, Juliet Lucy, and it sort of conjures up a ride along the California Pacific Coast Highway. I hope you'll enjoy this. It's new and it's from Young Gun Silver Fox.
Thank you.
like it was recorded in Malibu or Santa Monica, but actually recorded in the home studios of Sean Lee in West London, from an album West End Coast that I've been playing constantly in recent weeks. That's the lead track on the album, Young Gun Silver Fox, You Can Feel It. Jules, when we're young and finding our feet in the world, like Avril Lavigne, we're told by grown-ups that we should be honest and truthful, virtues that we're encouraged to believe enable us to live a trouble-free and happy life. Now, somehow these assets of integrity and veracity are not welcomed by football fans, and specifically by the followers of Everton Football Club. Their manager, Ronald Koeman, has backed their rivals, Liverpool, to win the Premier League. And, Jules, his candour, it's not been appreciated.
No, Everton fans not hugely keen on Ronald's... Ronald's expressions. Well, I think the problem is that Ronald's expressions of honesty have been somewhat multifaceted, really. So basically, his kind of telling it like it is comes in three forms, which is he thinks Liverpool will win the title, or thinks they might do. Liverpool being Everton's staunch rivals. He also is encouraging their star striker Lukaku to move on to another club, and in the next breath is then saying, oh, and why, by the way, one day I'd love to manage Holland. And the thing about the Holland team is they're not Everton. That's quite a crucial thing here. So in a way, I kind of admire Ronald's honesty. I think that's terrific. Everton fans less so. I think they feel that he's not committed. People can't have the cake and eat the cake. And I think there's a sort of a comparison to politics here, I think. People criticise the New Labour era for being all about spin and for there being a lack of honesty and there being, you know, there being just people in shiny suits and very much on message and stuff read from press statements and you know, everything being very bland and very uninteresting and very unauthentic. Then Gordon Brown gets caught in a car with a microphone still on, describing a woman who had some fairly regressive views on immigration as being, you know, poor old Gillian Duffy, that bigoted woman. And people then went ballistic about it, didn't they? I think in a way, if you're a football fan, you can't say, oh, you know, isn't he great, we've got character again, you know, he's a great manager, he's motivating us, you know, he tells it like it is. And then when he tells it like it is, saying, oh, isn't that terrible that he might want to manage Holland, I'd welcome that if I was a fan, because I think, well, at least we're being managed by someone that's got some ambition, that isn't, you know, just content to be 12th in the Premier League forevermore or something. I'm sure Mark Hughes and Tony Pulis are lovely chaps, but, you know, I wouldn't necessarily want a middle of the road type thing. So I, you know, perhaps there were better ways of putting it. But then the Dutch are not necessarily known for their they're known more for their plain speaking than they are for their sugarcoating. Possibly one of my favourite ever football quotes of all time. You might remember the Dutch, the disaster for Holland that was Euro 1996. I plug this every time, actually, every time we talk about Holland on the podcast, but I'm going to plug this again. There's a fantastic book that's been written that actually I would recommend to anyone, not just football fans, because it is so interesting. It's called Brilliant Orange. It came out years ago. I don't know if it's still in print. I got mine secondhand. It's by a chap called David Winner. It was first published in 2000, and it's called Brilliant Orange, The Neurotic Genius of Dutch Football. And it kind of explores the idea that in terms of pure talent and skill, the Dutch teams are always, you know, probably the greatest. They're certainly up there with Brazil. But when it comes down to actually winning, there seems to be something that kind of stops them psychologically from doing it. And one of the many reasons it's given is the fact that they do have this fantastic way of falling out with people and falling out with each other. And so Euro 96, they're approaching Euro 96. I think it was around this time that Patrick Kluivert, their star striker, managed to knock over and kill somebody in a car. So that was not helping them.
That's not going to help, is it? No.
However, Edgar Davids was on his way to getting ready to prepare, and someone interviewed him, and he wasn't terribly keen on their manager at the time. time. I think it might have been Gus Hiddings, actually, if I remember correctly. I apologize if I've got that wrong. And he said, it is difficult to prepare for a tournament properly when the coach of the team has his head and hands up the backside of certain players. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Edgar Davids was then not able to join the squad at Euro 96. He was promptly dispatched home, I suspect, with whatever the Dutch equivalent of a flea is in his ear. So yeah, Dutch football is not necessarily known for holding back. So in a way, I think some level of there is a sort of a cultural thing going on here, I think, with dear Ronald. But no, I am enjoying Ronald's candor. Maybe that's because I'm not an Everton fan. But you know, I like I say, there's a political comparison here. We can't want managers with character and then complain when they say things that we might not want to hear.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, experience tells us that almost all football management ends in failure. And
yes.
I gain much amusement noticing the disparity shown by some football managers. The grumpy, taciturn manners of, as an example, both Roy Keane and Gordon Strachan to reporters when they're in work. It's quite astounding that the rudeness that they show. Yet both inevitably find themselves clearing their desk where their managerial roles are brought to a close, and both then are rather fond of raking in the media shilling and grabbing at the opportunity to be one of the blokes in suits analysing Fenerbahce v Villarreal in the Europa League on BT Sport 4.
Living the dream, yeah.
Yeah, but one man who never changes and seems to treat all of life's ups and downs with the same sort of chirpy response is Ian Holloway, who has returned to your Queen's Park Rangers. He said,
I'm so pleased, Terence. I'm so pleased.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. Cause he said, I want to restore pride to the team. That's what he said. So you and your fellow QPR fans, pleased to see Ollie back.
Oh, I'm delighted to see Ian Holloway back. I mean, he's always had a bit of a checkered career at QPR. He and, you know, there are lots of... there's often the idea that when Paladini came in and took over the club in 2008 era, that, you know, old Ian Holloway was kind of forced out. And that's not necessarily the case. Although I think the manner in which he went, he got a job somewhere else. I think it was Blackpool. He went, he was offered a job somewhere else, which he took. And he then decided... they didn't want him to go, but they were going to put him on gardening leave at the same time. And it was such an unsatisfactory way, I think, for the time to have ended. The thing I like about Ian Holloway is he is someone that's always managed to take the fans with him. He's always managed to find a way of keeping people on board. And it says something that how skilled he is at that, that there are still a lot of people that believe that he was, you know, the kind of the hard luck tales about him being forced out by Paladini, which is not necessarily the case. So and also Ian Holloway is always good value being interviewed as well. And there is something about someone, again, he does tell it like it is, really. And I admire him for that. And he's someone that genuinely seems to care about QPR. And we had such a revolving door of managers after he left in 2008 and continue to have had a revolving door of managers. The only thing, speaking of personality, the only thing I can remember about Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank, the most recent incumbent, was that he was caught up in that newspaper sting. I can't remember anything else that he's ever said or anything else that he's ever kind of done at QPR, really. I very much enjoyed Holloway came just from Bristol Rovers, where he was sacked. He was initially seen as a bit of an uninspiring appointment. Jerry Francis, who managed us beforehand, we were heading for relegation, and Holloway started by explaining that he'd enjoyed the time off with his family, been in no rush to get back to football, but he then said, once you're bitten, you're a vampire and I can't wait to get started. And from that moment onwards, obviously, Ian Holloway was a bit of a different kettle of fish, really. So he's always shown solidarity with fans. There was talk of a stadium move at one point, or a merger or relocation, and his quote was, this is our cave and this is where we live. And he actually, I think, joined the fans in a sort of a protest, really. I'm enjoying. I know they say don't go back, and of course your Chelsea and Jose Mourinho is perhaps an example of
prime example
that might be less. I mean, we don't know how successful Ian Holloway is going to be at the moment, but certainly I get the impression that he might be. I know we're starting from a lower expectation base at QPR, to put it rather politely. But yeah, I Jose's return at Chelsea, your Chelsea, did not go well, did it?
It didn't. No. To put it mildly, indeed, his world's not exactly on fire at Manchester at the moment.
That's not going massively well.
I'm a fan of Ian Holloway. You know, one thing you know is he'll always give good quotes. But I tend to be in agreement with Don Henley of the popular music group The Eagles on such matters when he said in his hit tune The Boys of Summer, a little voice inside my head said, "Don't look back, you can never look back." I think those
are very true.
Sage words. But wish Ian Holloway rather, you know, all the best, and hope it turns round for QPR. It's a lovely club, QPR. Two or three years ago, I was there. I was at the ground, Loftus Road, for a sort of event, a meeting. They've got like a little conference area. And one of the deals was that, as a sort of sop to get people to attend, was that you could have a little tour of the ground while you were there. And so, oddly, I've had a tour of Loftus Road. And the thing And the thing that struck me about it, it was only about 2 years ago, was that it's a really small stadium, but the amazing thing is that how small the dressing rooms are. They're the size of, you know, a standard suburban sitting room, and it was quite strange to be in there and see all these star names. All the players have their own peg, which I thought was again quite unusual. But you're really wedged in, and
it's not spacious.
No, it's a tiny little place. But so I've got a kind of fondness over the years. I've been to QPR in the days before the Premier League, when you could just turn up to games, you know. And so you on a Saturday morning, you might sort of say to one of your mates, "Oh, Man United are playing QPR today. Should we pop down?" And you know, before the sort of hullabaloo of the Sky Money and the Premier League, you could do that. You could go to the First Division and
and
buy a ticket and go in and watch, you know, QPR free Man U. So. Yeah, but a lot of fondness for them, and I hope Ian Holloway, turns their fortunes round after.
He's going to make West London great again, Terence.
From her splendid album, Famous Blue Raincoat, devoted entirely to covers of Leonard Cohen songs, here's Jennifer Warnes. First, we take Manhattan.
Was die Attentäter betrifft, die in Berlin den Anschlag auf die deutsch-arabische Gesellschaft verübt. Ist die Polizei einen Schritt weiter gekommen, der nach dem Anschlag.
They sentenced me to 20 years of boredom, but trying to change the system from sister. I don't like those drugs that keep you thin. I don't like what happened to my sister. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take
with Stevie Ray Vaughan on guitar, first we take Manhattan. Jennifer Ward's a long-time collaborator, friend and backing singer with Leonard Cohen, who died earlier this week. And we picked a cover version, and I think, like me, Jules, you may believe that Leonard Cohen's work is best heard covered by other artists.
Yes, I mean, my dad used to say this about Bob Dylan, that Bob Dylan songs are he enjoys them the most when performed by people that are not Bob Dylan. And sorry, purists. And and I feel very much the same, I think, about Leonard Cohen. I mean, I think that the chap was a very, very talented man. That was clear. I don't listen to his music very much. I don't listen to him singing his songs very much. It's not that I don't like them. It's just never really moved me in a huge way, particularly, well, the music hasn't anyway. Therefore, a lesson for some people is I'm not going to say that he's rubbish or he's not good because it doesn't affect me. It just hasn't affected me hugely, but I can definitely realise that he is extremely talented. Hallelujah by Jeff Buckley, I absolutely adore. I think that version is wonderful. I love hearing different versions of Hallelujah. K.D. Lang's version is excellent as well. It truly is a kind of a seminal song that I think will live on for decades, if not centuries, frankly. So I think that Leonard Cohen is an incredibly talented chap. I couldn't even tell you why I don't enjoy listening to his music. I don't know. It's just never really clicked for me. But I do think he's very talented, and I do think his songs are terrific.
Back in the 70s, when I was at college, girls fell into two categories. there were those who clustered round tiny radios, hoping that Radio 1 would play the latest single from Donny Osmond or David Cassidy. And the other girls, usually wearing duffel coats, who carried round...
I have a duffel coat, I am that girl.
Yeah, you may well have been. They used to carry around vinyl LPs by...
yes, I am that girl.
you are that girl. By Cat Stevens, Clifford T. Ward, and especially Leonard Cohen. And his album Songs of Leonard Cohen, with its song So Long Mary Ann and Suzanne, it was kind of revered. But it's strange to say that the abiding memory I do have is that with my generation it was almost exclusively women who owned Leonard Cohen albums back then. He's obviously, you know, appealed to a wider market since then, but he was very much the choice of the alternative sort of 17-year-old college lady student back then. George,
I wonder if that's because of his emotional honesty.
I suppose so. I think there was singer-songwriters, there was a sort of genre at that time, sort of 72, 73 maybe, and there was Joni and James Taylor, but they seemed to have an appeal across the genders.
Yeah.
But there was this sort of small group of, perhaps one would say, introspective singer-songwriters. I think Cat Stevens, Clifford T. Ward would fit into that category, who perhaps brought a bit more individual meaning, and it seemed to appeal to teenagers and particularly women, I think, at that time. Mm.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah, Jules, now I know that from following you on social media, you've been painting the South Coast all shades of red in the last week.
Yes, I've had a fabulous time.
Maybe you could reveal to us your public appearances in the coming week.
Well, less exciting, actually. I don't have any. I don't. Well, as far as I'm aware, I don't have any things this evening. This week, I'm going to see Laura and Vuda this evening, uh-huh. So I'm looking forward to that. I will report back next week on that. Hmm. I will be doing some radio. It was the Saturday Social last night. We reached you in the A to Z, which we finally managed to fill an hour of you. I'm still not entirely sure how that happened, but we did. So this week, it's just Indie Wonderland on Barricade Radio from 8 until 10 p.m. BarricadeRadio.com or via TuneIn. We just do the usual thing of 2 hours of cheery chat and some good quality Indian alt-rock tunes.
Okay, well...
I'm also going away next weekend as well. I'm going to make Nottingham great again.
Well, that's outrageous.
I know. So I will report back on the wild of Nottingham as well.
George, I know you've been thinking about the number of, we talked about Leonard Cohen a moment ago, we put it this way, musical deaths in 2016. And also, when we were planning the content of this podcast, we were thinking about links between music, emotion, and death. And, you know, that's okay to talk about that. I think your story... maybe perhaps a little bit more uplifting than mine, but my tale is of how the music of Prince affects me. It was one of the best gigs I've ever been to, Prince at the O2 in London, 31st of August 2007. He was at his sort of blistering best. He did all the hits, and then a bit bizarrely, I suppose, he waited until the O2 was more or less emptied at the end of the gig, and then came back on and did another 30 minutes of hits for the maybe, at most 2,000 or 3,000 people left in the O2.
Yes. And I think you've talked about this before. It sounded jaw-dropping, really.
It really was. But it was one of those times that London was on high alert for terror attacks back in 2007. And this led to an odd situation. My girlfriend and I, we travelled back on the river by one of those fast river cruises. It's a really nice way to go around London. It takes you back to the pier by the London Eye at Waterloo. But some men on the boat were behaving really oddly, and my girlfriend became convinced that the boat was going to be blown up as we went under Tower Bridge. She really got this sort of fixation about it, got really, really worried. Luckily, these lads got off at Tower Bridge, and I think they just had too much to drink. But her conviction that something awful was going to happen stayed with us. We kept thinking about Prince and how great he was, and we played a CD of his greatest hits in the car on the way back home. But something felt odd. And 12 hours later, I got a phone call. My father had died. And suddenly everything in the world was different. And I think if I'm to be completely open about this, I think the world has never quite been for me the same again. I still listen to Prince, and I can just about untangle that great gig, Prince's songs, and my father dying. And I know in my heart there's no direct link, but I can't quite untie the two emotions, the sort of euphoria of that night at the O2, and then the sort of life-sapping sadness of my father dying 12 hours later. I'm kind of hoping that your recollection is not quite so stark as mine.
I am, although it was some time ago, I am very sorry for your loss, and I'm sorry in a way. There is always something, and I think I've had evenings before where I've had wonderful evenings, and then I've had not great news at the end, and it is almost like sort of hitting a wall, really, isn't it? And it is ironic that to get such a release from you, and I think we've talked to sort of we alluded to this earlier. Music does have this kind of inevitable binding up with our emotions, doesn't it? Which is why to have it be associated with something very, very happy, and then to have that sort of scotched almost immediately afterwards is a very difficult thing to process. I have a couple of records which are sort of tied up with deaths of family members for me. I had years ago, and this really was years ago, this would have been 2002, I think, the year I did my A-levels, my grandfather had been very, very ill and basically died over a very long period of time, which was pretty excruciating. And on the day that he actually died, we had a phone call in sort of 9:45 in the morning, and it was one of those things. Do you remember the days of dial-up internet, Terence?
I do, the screeching modem.
Yes, get off the phone, I want to use the internet. Well, I was on the internet sort of 9:30 in the morning in our spare room, and as soon as I took the phone cable out of the modem and plugged it back into the wall, the phone rang instantly. So someone had obviously been trying to get through. And it was someone from the hospital where my grandfather was. I know, I think it was in the hospital, actually, to say, we think you might go today. And so I instantly ran downstairs and told my parents, who then got in the car and drove off and kind of left me to man the fort at home. And I remember my mum saying afterwards, she was very glad that, that my grandfather then took until 8 o'clock that evening to pass away, because otherwise I'd have felt pretty bad, I think, if that was the case. But well, I sort of busied myself at home, revising for Ed Evans and doing all sorts of things. And I bought a record by a band called Hefner on vinyl, and it was reasonably unusual in those days. We didn't have the vinyl revival we do now, and I remember playing it and my parents came home about an hour later and said that he died, and I'd managed to work out that I was probably listening to that record whilst he died. It took me 12 years to listen to that record. I'd never listened to it again since.
Whereas
actually there have been some circumstances where listening to certain records has really helped me understand. And my grandmother died 2007, I think. And I'd very recently bought an album by a band called The Good, The Bad and The Queen. Which is one of Damon Albarn's many side projects. That's the name of the band and the name of the album as well. And I don't think they're going to do anything else, but that was a sort of one-off album. Paul Cinnamon from your class, he played the bass. And it's a wonderful album because it's really kind of... There's a great melancholy to it, as there is with a lot of Damon Albarn stuff. But there's a lot of wisdom to it as well. It's a very gentle album in lots of ways, but kind of becomes more frenetic when it needs to. And I listened to it. I had my Discman, such was it that those days. I had my Discman and my headphones, and we were driving up to Twickenham to my grandmother's funeral from Hastings, so a couple of hours. And I listened to it on the way, and actually it was the perfect soundtrack because there was something about it, the word that I sort of think of is inevitability, really, and the idea that death is the one thing in life that is inevitable. We will all get there in the end. None of us will get out of this alive. But in a way, that record kind of taught me, the whole vibe of it taught me, that actually there is a kind of a gentle acceptance in inevitability, as well as a sadness to inevitability. There's also a happiness to it too. And my nan had been extremely ill, and in a way the fact that she had died was a great relief. I remember that week when we were just sort of waiting for her to go, really, and I was going into work every day, and my colleagues had been very kind to me. I remember the day that I walked in and told them that she'd gone, and everyone was very kind. In a way, it was just sort of a relief. And actually, listening to this album, it was the perfect soundtrack, because there was a melancholy to it, but there's also quite comfort to this record as well. And this was the song that particularly stuck with me. So this is The Good, The Bad and The Queen, and this is the wonderfully gentle and warm Northern Wail.
Well,
You have been listening to a DACA Media production.